Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Hi, this is Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, and we are here the end of December 2012. Today is December 19th, and we are back with Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim talking about Digitalis, the wonder drug. And we have a lot of other information and questions and answers from the master guru of homeopathy from India. Thank you all for listening each and every week with us. We have a variety of shows. I want to start off while we're waiting for Dr. Adil to sign into the show. I have a quote to begin. This is from Rav Schneerson. It says, "People have the wrong idea about restrictions. They imagine that if you restrict what you eat and what you do not, when you work and when you meditate and pray, what you wear, where you go, all these restrictions will suffocate any sense of inspiration. The truth is, without any restrictions, your inspiration will quickly dissipate. Focus your light like a laser into an intense, powerful beam, and it will last." And I'm going to check in. Dr. Otto, were you able to hear the quote that I began the show with?
I could not hear it completely.
Okay.
Just the end part of it I heard.
Let me try one more time, because it really has a lot of depth and application to it for the way we are living our lives today and all of the horrors that we are seeing around the world, and perhaps individually and societally. How can we apply this thought? And it's from Rav Schneerson, who says, "People have the wrong idea about restrictions. They imagine that if you restrict what you eat and what you do not, when you work and when you meditate and pray, what you wear, where you go, all these restrictions will suffocate any sense of inspiration. The truth is, without any restrictions, your inspiration will quickly dissipate. Focus your light like a laser into an intense, powerful beam, and it will last." And, you know, you can probably take this any which way, inspiration as being breathing or mentally, mentally, emotionally inspiration. You know, there's so much richness to a quote like this. You could probably talk for an hour just about
exactly
what he's
and,
getting at.
In the times which we are living, maybe the Connecticut shootout, or it may be the recent rape case in New Delhi, and many, many more such happening throughout the world. I mean, inspiration, the youth has to take inspiration, and we have to stop these atrocities. It's a high time that this syphilitic miasm of destruction of others and self is taking a deep turn. It is always taking, haunting the society. But the incidences are happening way too soon.
Too often, too many. And, you know, some people, now I don't know whether I agree with this completely. Some people tell me it has always been exactly like this. It's just because of social networking and the media and the news, how fast it travels and how we're all connected through the World Wide Web, that we hear about it more. But something in me tells me that...
I disagree with this, not in total, but I disagree to a great extent because it has not always been this way, yes. But how the media and the social networking sites have helped, they have helped us to sensitize. These issues cannot be taken lightly. They would have been occurring. Delhi is known for such incidences from such quite a long time. It would not be... wrong to name it the capital of all such atrocities. I'm feeling ashamed to say that of my own capital, but then what to do?
It's very frightening to have to admit that these things are occurring in your region, where you live.
Exactly. Since it happens, it's happening to our society in our vicinity. We have a sense of fear, develop a sense of fears because even I have a daughter, even I have a wife and my mom, they are not safe. So I have to think in those terms as well. But still, Indian mindset is quite solid. We have endured much, much more. And probably this incident has given enough an impetus to the local people, the youth. Hopefully it does so to the government because... such incidences cannot be allowed to happen, not only in New Delhi, but anywhere in India and the world around. I was shocked listening to the Connecticut shootouts the last time it had happened. And when President Barack Obama, he actively supported the planned legislation reinstating a national ban on assault weapons. So that it's another form of violence. And this is another form of violence. Such violences cannot be tolerated. In a civil society, if we call ourselves civil, we have no place for such things. And everyone, every sane individual has to go against it.
Yes. And that's part of the inspirational quote. What are the restrictions that must be taken individually and societally to be inspired and to inspire others and to create a better world? I don't really know for sure within myself about a gun ban. I think that I have to look at it closely, investigate what really works. And I really feel that we need to go even deeper than just the guns. I think that there's...
It is the psychology. We have to change the psychology.
Yes.
Simply by banning guns or simply by increasing the policing and making disciplining the youth, it is more of changing the mindset. See, fun cannot be at the cost of someone's life and someone's dignity. It's way too cruel to do such things. I was imagining, had such a patient come to me, the rapist, what drug I would have given. It's a very cruel act. It's a very wicked act. The day when it happened, we were discussing whether we could, this rapist, suppose if we consider rapist number one, there were about, 4 to 5 people. But suppose individually, if you consider, would you have given them anacardium because of wickedness? Because it was not only a sexual act. It was way more than that. So anacardium, nitric acid, what sort of aberrantism, cruelty, wickedness, how wicked such people could be?
Well, we don't know unless we speak to the individual, would we?
Exactly. We were just thinking about...
And it's a group event. When it's a gang of people, so it's a group event, so what does that tell us?
That tells us a mass hysterical psychology. The the hysteria or the frenzy, a single person of the group, I think one person would have been the dominant person, and he would have charged the entire group to do so, such an act.
Mm-hmm.
So that itself speaks, highly of the way the society is going, at least in India. Anyway,
okay.
The last interview of our show is today, and today I would like to pay homage to two important leaders in homeopathy. One is an Indian leader called as Dr. B.K. Bose. And the other one is Dr. Farrington, Ernest A. Farrington. So I would be speaking on something about the life of these two gentlemen. Dr. B.K. Bose has been and will be a very, very great Indian homeopath. And in his lifetime, these were the words used for him. The beard saint-looking gentleman who walks erect, travels every day in trams and buses at peak office hours, has a voice which usually needs no mic in any meeting or gathering, is above 80 years in age, and he is none other than Dr. B.K. Bose, the only living student of immortal Kent in this part of globe. So when he was alive, he was my father's teacher. So I hear stories of this gentleman. I have never had the chance to see him. So this man was born in 1879. His father was an additional judge, and so he had all that is known as a respectable family, luxurious life, and elated environment. But it was a period when Indian nationalism was awakening itself from a slumberous sleep of foreign domination. I should remind the audience that India was ruled by the Britishers for more than 200 years. So when Indian independence was at its peak, foreign domination and a bright hope of India, independent India, was drawing on this vast continent, Bengal, the undivided Bengal at that time, because now it is West Bengal and East Bengal. The East Bengal is Bangladesh and West Bengal still is in India. So Bengal, the undivided Bengal, was the seat of the greatest turbulence and political unrest. The British government wanted to cow down the independent spirit of Bengal, and so the conspiracy of partition of Bengal was hatched. Bengal fought to its fame, and Bijoy Kumar Bose, B.K. Bose's full name was Bijoy Kumar Bose. He joined the movement wholeheartedly. He considered it to be his personal war. The boy whom the family and the parents wanted to be an ICS, Indian Civil Servant, became a rebel, an underground terrorist, an absconder. He wanted to overthrow the empire whom his family wanted him to serve. To avoid arrest, to learn the advanced techniques of manufacturing hand grenades, and to acquire arms for struggle, he fled to France with great difficulties with no money. The British government pressed for the French government for his arrest and extradition, and the same story of haunt and run started in France. He had to leave France, and with the help of some local Indians and sympathizers, he went to USA. Local authorities in USA wanted to know the object of his sojourn. Explanations were unsatisfactory, pressure started mounting, and as a hideout, he took admission into New York Homeopathic Medical College and Flower Hospital as a cover. But the place had no utility for his main objective. He shifted to Ann Arbor and entered the University of Michigan. 2 years he was there studying nonviolence in recognized university and violence in the shadowy underworld.
Wow!
There he came. Yeah.
That really ties in really with what's happening today, doesn't it?
Exactly. He came in contact with Dr. Dewey, Smith, etc., and Dewey directed him to J.T. Kent in Herring Medical College. He was granted an interview with the dean. And it is quite interesting, Debbie. The dean was an interesting gentleman, and he asked, "Well, Bose, you want to take admission in the homeopathic department?" And Bose replied, "Yes, sir," was a prompt but humble reply. "Is homeopathy recognized in your country?" Answer was, "No, sir." Calm admission of a fact. "Will you get any service when you go there after obtaining homeopathic degree?" "No, sir," the same obedient, humble voice. "Then you must be a damn fool to study this science, which has no service, no recognition, no future for you." This was the dean speaking. The inside rebel took charge. No more calm voice, no more obedient humbleness. The sharp voice came like a crash of a whip. "And sir, You must be a greater fool teaching students who have no scope of future in their countries, and a government must be the greatest of all foolish governments, granting passports and visas to such students. You were slaves, we are slaves. You are independent, and we will be independent. The students of independent India will not come to study homeopathy here. They shall have their own college. This story was narrated by the dean in the farewell speech to graduating students, in which there were two more Indian students. Kent heard the story, gave a friendly smile and a fatherly pat, and took him to Herring College, Homeopathic Medical College. So in fact, it was Kent who transformed this rebel into a homeopath, this anarchist into a healer of human sufferings. The non-violence of reasoning and understanding won over the violence of youth and immaturity. The desire to change by force surrendered before the will to serve. The political agitator and worker became a humanist. A physician, Bijoy Kumar Bose, became a medical graduate.
Wonderful. Yes, that was great.
And Dr. B.K. Bose then became an MD. He started his practice in Calcutta with two other co-fellows, Dr. D.N. Ray and Yunnan. And this soft-spoken, shy, introvert, handsome, convinced Kentian young homeopaths with elite habits and aristocratic choice for things was invited to Banaras by some eminent political leaders. He started his practice there and became the family physician of Sri Motilal Nehru. Motilal Nehru was the father of Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India. It was there he established a lucrative practice and visited the Maharajas of India and its neighboring countries on professional calls. It was a life of service, fame and luxury. The Calcutta Homeopathic Medical College is the first college of its kind in the entire country, and it has grown up. The hut is replaced by a palatial building of three blocks. And in fact, my father studied in this Calcutta Homeopathic Medical College. So in 1997, when I passed my MBBS, and I told him that since you have studied in the college, I also want to see your college. Because he keeps on, he's too proud of his college. I said, I also want to visit this college, this institute. I want to see homeopathy in practice, actual practice in indoor patients. It was in 1997, and he had taken me there. And really, it has a great grandeur still, after so many years. So the 5-bedded hospital is now a 200-bedded hospital with 10 wards, and I am very happy to say that real homeopathy is practiced in Calcutta Homeopathic Medical College. So this gentleman, Dr. B.K. Bose, passed away on 16th of December 1977 in a ripe old age of 90 years. And in all these years, he has given to Indian homeopathy whatever one can give, whatever maximum one can give. And with these words, the nature shall rise and say, here was a man like him I shall not see again. My tributes to late Dr. B.K. Bose.
Marvelous. That was just perfect for today.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another gentleman who really deserves our appreciation was born on 1st January 1847. And he passed away on 15th of December 1885. And he was none other than Dr. Ernest A. Farrington. Dr. Ernest Farrington is a well-known homeopathic, he is well-known in the homeopathic world, and his contributions is immense, especially for the clinical materia medica. He was born in Williamsburg in New York. His family left Brooklyn for Philadelphia when Farrington was very young, and so he received his education in Philadelphia. Nature had endowed Farrington with sharp perception, exceptional memory, genial manners and helping nature. He was distinguished as a pupil and popular among his schoolmates. His power to grasp and assimilate facts cherished him as a phenomenal pupil in the eyes of his teachers. At 19 years of age, he passed from Philadelphia High School, breaking all records of previous examination of the institution. Congratulations, Dr. Farrington. For a long time, he was remembered by his teachers for his aptness, clearness of thought and remarkable proficiency. In the summer of 1866, he visited New York, and he matriculated from Homeopathic Medical School in Pennsylvania, where his intelligence, memory, and conscientiousness, in addition to religious bent of mind, earned him the admiration and affection of his fellow students and teachers alike. In March of 1868, he graduated again from Hahnemann Medical College in Philadelphia. In 1861, he started his practice, homeopathic practice, at Mount Vernon Street. His studious nature and engagements in practice soon affected his health, and in 1864, he took a short European trip, which improved his health. In the spring of 1869, he was appointed as a lecturer in forensic medicine in Hahnemann Medical College. In 1874, as a professor of Materia Medica, after the resignation of the famous Dr. Guernsey, and thus Farrington attained the dream and aim of his life, because it was Materia Medica which was his cherished field of labor, deepest studies, and it was in this subject that his life's work began. He made deep and analytical studies in the matters of homeopathic principles, rules, dosage, potency, and the content and the teaching methods of Materia Medica. On 13 September 1871, Farrington married Miss Elizabeth Atkin, who proved to be a woman perfectly suited to his professional and religious inclinations. The couple had three sons and one daughter. His contributions are tremendous. In 1874, he wrote a supplement to Gross Comparative Materia Medica. In 1887, a Clinical Materia Medica. And in 1890, the same, that is a Clinical Materia Medica, second edition, with more drug illustrations. His other literary contributions include Syllabus to Materia Medica, Lesser Writings with Therapeutic Hints, and all those who are newcomers to homeopathy, I should advise them that they should go through this Lesser Writings with Therapeutic Hints of Farrington. They are really good, it's a wonderful book. Editing of Herring's Condensed Materia Medica and co-editing of Hahnemannian Monthly. Hahnemannian Monthly was a very reputed journal of his times. And in 1890, I don't know whether it's still published or not, but I have read about this Hahnemannian Monthly. Very small, or two or three pages, page newsletters, and wonderful information about various provings. And after all these provings were collected, and Farrington compiled it. So Farrington was a man of strong and vigorous constitution, which gave him the strength of carrying various labors without serious effects to his health. And he passed away on 15th of December 1885 at Philadelphia at the age of 38 years, 11 months and 16 days. I am 38 years.
He was very young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In his death, the faculty and students of Hahnemannian Medical College and Philadelphia Country Homeopathic Medical College lost a guide and a source of strength. And we, the entire homeopathic community, lost a great stalwart in Dr. Ernest A. Farrington. Again, as a student of homeopathy, I should pay tribute to this great master.
Thank you.
And before going on to the topic, that is Digitalis, and Digitalis again has been taken, shifting away from the rubrics, especially taken because one viewer or one person of the audience requested, and it was a question that how come, please throw light on Digitalis. So I have taken both aspects of Digitalis, the allopathic aspect and the homeopathic aspect, and we shall see what exactly is the role of Digitalis in today's perspective. But before that, I should answer two or three good questions. And one question is from Dr. Bharne, from a very, very small village, Lanji. It is quite near to Nagpur. It's about 3.5 hours journey. So, and he says, "Sir, I am practicing homeopathy in a very small village near Balaghat district. I have under my care 6 patients of end-stage renal disease who require dialysis frequently. Although I do administer symptomatic homeopathic medicines, yet dialysis needs to be continued for all of them. For this, the patients need to travel to the city. It's a costly affair and very impractical for the patients. Is there a method where I may learn and do the dialysis at the village itself?" Well, yes, of course. Nowadays, dialysis can be done at the patient's home itself. And the method is called as continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis, CAPD. Continuous ambulatory, that means the patient is mobile. Peritoneal, that is the dialysis done by the peritoneum. It is a simple and a domiciliary treatment. The patient need not go to the hospital and can continue with his or her daily routine. There is no requirement of expensive equipment and trained medical manpower, and is better tolerated by the patient, especially diabetics, hypertensives, and those suffering from ischemic heart disease. There is better control of blood pressure since there is a greater removal of sodium. Also, there is no blood loss, so the hemoglobin concentration is maintained. There is a better preservation of residual renal function, which plays a very important role in deciding the prescription of hemoperitoneal dialysis. The dietary restriction of sodium and potassium is less as compared to hemodialysis. Now, the only dreaded complication of the CAPD is peritonitis, and that is if it is not done properly or not done in sterile conditions. So even if you can, I mean, you can do it safely, it's a procedure which is learned very easily. Not, it does not take much skills to do so, but the only thing I can suggest is please make the environment sterile. So you may learn the procedure from any nephrologist and can conduct the same at your village. So you have got a bright future with your patients as far as dialysis is concerned, and I pray that with homeopathy, your dialysis sessions should get lesser and lesser. If you are giving correct homeopathy, then you may need not do much dialysis, but even if you have to do, learn it. It's a simple skill and a very, very important therapeutic skill for your patients.
In previous talks together, you have mentioned homeopathic remedies for this illness.
Yeah. Now, end-stage renal disease, one of the finest remedies that we use, and we use it with great effect, is Zinzibar. Z-I-N-Z-I-B-R, Zinzibar. It is for end-stage renal disease. Second is Senna, and third is Solidago. These three are tremendously helpful when the kidneys have absolutely shut down. And, I mean, if they don't respond, then the next drug which we give them is opium. Zinzibar or Senna or even Solidago have to be used in potency and not only in mother tincture form, because we have seen, in our experience, that potencies, but lower potencies, 6 or at the most 30, they act much better than the mother tincture form. They can be repeated 3 times a day or 4 times a day as the symptoms demand. Now, how do you decide whether to use Zinzibar or whether to use Senna or whether to use Solidago? Suppose you have got only renal symptoms with no other systems involved. For example, the patient is not having constipation because of chronic or acute renal failure, or does not have skin symptoms or anything else. Then you may use Solidago. If the patient has together constipation, then it's an indication of Senna, because Senna is an absolutely good remedy used since long, long time as a herb for constipation. But very few know that in potentized form, it acts as a wonderful diuretic also. It actually rejuvenates the kidneys. So if it's constipation, then, and if it's accompanied with skin symptoms, then you can use Zinzibar. Now, skin symptoms, that means you may not have eruptions, but because of the dry skin, you have excessive itching and the discomfort feeling on the skin. So if that is there, and kidney failure, renal shutdown is there, then Zinzibar is there. Suppose if these three you have given day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, but there's not doesn't seem to work, then give a dose of opium in very high potency, say 1 mg or 10 mg, only single dose, and repeat the same drug, and then you can get results. That
okay.
is end-stage renal disease. But suppose if the patient is well-maintained with a high creatinine, and you want to decrease only the creatinine, and you don't have enough symptoms, or the symptoms are not very common symptoms, the two drugs, if there is great swelling, then APIS. If there is no swelling, then EELS serum.
What is that last one? Great swelling is what?
If the patient has swelling throughout the body because of the renal failure, then it is APIS, APIS mellifica.
Okay.
And if there is no swelling, but still the creatinine is high and the urea is high, then you have got EELS serum. EELS. EELS serum.
Okay.
And we again give them in potency. I generally give them in millisimal potency starting from 0 by 1. And I really get very good results. And we have loads of patients their dialysis have decreased. I even stopped with use of these drugs.
Okay.
So, I've got many more other questions to continue. I hope I could have I've answered your question, Dr. Barney. The next question is from Karachi, Pakistan. That is from Dr. Arif Hussain. And he says, in Allen's keynotes in the chapter of acid phos, it is written, interstitial inflammation of bones, scrofulous, psychotic, syphilitic, mercurial, periosteum inflamed. Please throw light. Well, I don't know what you want to ask, Dr. Aris. Do you want to ask that interstitial inflammation of bones? See, whenever there's, let me explain this entire sentence. That is, I believe what you want to ask. Interstitial inflammation of bones. Now, the bony tissue is surrounded by a membrane which is called as periosteum. And it is this periosteum which can undergo inflammatory changes. Now, whenever a periosteum is inflamed, then there is a local inflammation, and because of the local inflammation, the nearby glands can get inflamed. So, it is written scrofulous. Now, inflammation need not always be infective, it's related to infection. If it's infection, only then can you have, or you generally can have, a gland enlargement. The nearby, the draining gland can be enlarged if it's an infective procedure. Suppose if it is malignant change, then psychotic it is written. If it is a syphilitic change, that means because of the inflammation, ultimately you can have abscess or pus inside, then it is syphilitic. Syphilitic and mercurial are one and the same, because in mercurial poisoning, when initially it was there in Hahnemann's time, we could see interstitial inflammation of bones. Nowadays it is not seen. So actually the author, that is Allen, has combined all these words and written as such. And what he wants to say is there are different types of inflammation. A scrofulous inflammation could be a psoric inflammation. You can have an infection, a small infection, a staphylococci or a streptococcal infection. It will last for certain days. Very painful. It may enlarge the nearing draining nodes. So you can have a scrofulous or a scrofula. Or you can have a psychotic inflammation. Again, interstitial inflammation of the bones. It is generally related to a bone malignancy, like an osteochondroma or osteosarcoma. And you can have a syphilitic inflammation. Then you can have an abscess around there, that place. Now it can be a cold abscess, it can be tuberculosis, or it can be a bacterial abscess other than tuberculosis. Then the third question.
That's very advanced in the medical terminology. For one thing, I need to note for listeners about the Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio Show is educational, and if you do have any kind of health concern, you must see your own healthcare provider, and that this is an educational discussion, and that Dr. Adel is answering questions that come in to him through his website, homeoacad.org, and that he's answering medical questions to other physicians. So
yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to be a bit technical to make the other person understand. I mean, I can't help using simpler words.
Absolutely. But just to clarify to people who are just popping in to listen to the show, not knowing what to expect.
Exactly. The third question is quite interesting and is asked by Dr. Nirupama. She seems to be an Indian from Houston, Texas. And she says, if vital force is a force, can't it be measured like other forces in the cosmos? Likewise, miasm is also a force, although corrupt. Hence, can't it too be objectively measured? Well, I am not a physicist. I hope I would have been a physicist to answer this question. So, Dr. Nirupama, this question is of importance to physicists or those scientists with a materialistic bent of mind. How does it matter to homeopath whether or not vital force or miasm can or cannot be measured by any means? We should be interested in the expressions of the functional or structural of the vital force or the deranged vital force upon the economy, and the methods of rectifying the derangement by the selection of proper simillimum and subsequent follow-up. But a theory or a hypothesis, well put, can it be measured? It could have been measured, or it can be measured, but I don't know how it can be. So this is the, basically a question for the physicist and not for the clinical homeopath to be inquired. But anyway, since you have asked me, I would also, you know, it has ignited a sense of query in my mind. And hopefully I'll ask my physicist friends, and sometime in my life, I would hope to get the answer and get measured, this vital force get measured. And if it does, then the relevance of measuring the vital force would also be known to us. What is your take on this, Debbie? Any views?
My take on the vital force, is it a force? And can it be measured? I think that there will always be adventurers and explorers in the realms, whether it's the cosmos, the astronomers, or those who are looking under the microscope or the electron microscope, either the smallest or the largest they can possibly seek to travel. They will continually search out for themselves these answers, because we have the capacity of the intellect to try and find answers to unknown questions and be explorers. I think that this is really true for actually the situations today, when we see senseless acts of violence and we want to find an answer for how and why these things occur. What is the force behind these actions? And we will.
It is actually a corrupt miasm force. It's a miasmatic force. It's a corrupt vital force. The reason for this mind to be a perverted mind, this perversions, it is actually nothing but a corrupt vital force.
Yeah, but is that enough to make a person feel satisfied?
Actually, that forms the base. That forms the base for his or her actions. If you don't have perversion of the vital force, or if you don't have miasmatic this. So, because even Kent says that the basis for all miasms is sin, and vice versa, the cycle continues. Once sinned, then the miasm is instilled, the soric miasm instilled, and sora is also transmitted by touch. So then, from then on, the miasm can evolve into either psychosis or syphilis. Of course, that's a long and a debatable theory, but still, basis is miasm, as homeopaths believe, and we have got drugs which correct the miasmatic state. So that's why, when this incident happened, this rape case, and I was actually just discussing with my family over dinner, as to suppose if such patients come to us, if they need homeopathic help, what drugs should we give them? I mean, what drugs would come to our mind for such types of acts?
The thing is that these acts occur and continue to occur on a daily basis, and we see things that are terrifying and unconscionable and unacceptable, and we need to find answers to these questions in the material world. Of course, so is Dr. Nirupama from Houston, Texas. We know there is a vital force, and do we need to measure it, or do we need to learn from it? Do we need to not just to measure it, not in a like a ruler,
physical or physical terminology. Yeah.
But what useful measure can it be to life and society to improve the world? Once we acknowledge that there is such a thing as this life force that is creating this movement for people's actions and thoughts and emotions, what can we do? I guess I don't want to, you know, we don't want to be placated. We don't want to be satisfied. We're still searching for a way, you know, whatever it is that you're interested in, that's your purpose in the world. So there will be people who will look for the measurement, and there will be people who will look for how to do good in the world.
Yeah. At the most, I think, Nirupama, if we are able to measure by some standards the force of the vital force or the biasm, at the most, it would help us in gauging the potency of medicines. See, nowadays, the science of pathology in homeopathy, although there are certain laws guiding it, but still there are many questions. And if we are able to correctly gauge or measure in physical terms what you actually have asked me, whether we can, can't we measure the miasm. Suppose if we are able to measure the miasm, we can actually give you the exact potency if that is so. So it would help us in measuring the drug miasm as well as the disease miasm in a living constitution, if at all it can ever happen. It's just a hypothesis. But it can help us as to my understanding. Other than that, it has hardly any role to play. But still, quite a good question. It has come out of your intellect and your intuitive capacity. And I congratulate all my audience viewers for asking me questions. And you help us in igniting our knowledge, and we help you by trying to answer. I don't know if I am able to satisfy everyone, but that's the most I can do.
We appreciate all of your involvement and time that you devote to these shows every week. And I know there's a lot of preparation involved as well, which people may not realize.
Yeah, for every interview, it gives me, 1 week gives me a breathing space. And there are certain topics which you want to discuss. You have got lots of cases also, but because of lack of time and manpower and other things, we may not always each PowerPoint presentation, you require good source materials, authentic materials, and everything has to be collected and put in display. So how much ever I can do, I do. If I get time, sometimes there are less number of patients. It's possible in some week the patient's number exceed and I can't get time. Emergencies, then at that time, I have just have to speak randomly. Anyway, so the topic today is quite interesting, and it's a fit topic to end the year, and that is Digitalis purpurea. The most commonly used preparation of Digitalis is digoxin, which is obtained from the leaves of Digitalis lanata, a common flowering plant called foxglove. If audience is listening, then we have posted a PowerPoint presentation. You may go ahead. It has the Digitalis plant has beautiful flowers, very good flowers to look at. And I've given you a picture, a purple-colored flower picture is there. Now, we are basically going to digitalize a wonderful homeopathic drug. And it has varied number of action. It's a fully proved drug. But I am only going to discuss Digitalis vis-a-vis heart. And we're going to compare Digitalis in modern medicine use, that is allopathy and homeopathy. So, when we are talking about Digitalis, the seat of action in the heart is the AV node or the atrioventricular node. For those who are lay people, let me remind you that nodes or heart cells are special cells, and they can fire or they can generate electricity. All cardiac cells. Of them, of those cardiac cells, few get together and form node. Now these nodes, one is the SA node or the sinoatrial node, which lies in the right atrium. Atrium means the chamber of the heart. The upper chamber of the heart is called atrium. So the right atrium has the sinoatrial node. It is called the pacemaker of the heart because the impulse it generates is the most in intensity, and that actually causes your heart to beat. The next in line is the atrioventricular node. It is named because it lies midway between the right atrium and the right ventricle. So it is the AV node or the atrioventricular node. Coming back to Digitalis, the seat of action at the molecular level or the organic level is the atrioventricular node. And what it does to the atrioventricular node? It causes increased intracellular calcium. in those cardiac cells which comprise the atrioventricular node. Moment the digitalis starts action, there is an intracellular calcium increase, and because of that, the AV node, whenever the cell has got increased amount of calcium, then it gets charged, and that causes increased automaticity and decreased AV conduction. Now, every heart cell is also a conductor. Apart from generating electricity, it can also conduct electricity. Same way, AV node can conduct. Generally, in normal people, when the SA node is active, it does not generate electricity itself. It only conducts the electricity from or the impulse from the AV SA node to the ventricles. But in the presence of digitalis, there is raised intracellular calcium, and it itself becomes, automaticity is increased, and it starts generating impulses or electrical impulses or electricity, and there is decreased conduction. The clinical use that therefore for digitalis for hundreds of years has been in heart failure, congestive cardiac failure, or the common abbreviation we use is CCF. Also, when heart failure is frequently accompanied with arrhythmias, we will see in detail those arrhythmias. When the heart is dilated, normally the heart is a muscular structure. It has the ability to contract and relax. But in certain conditions, the heart gets dilated, then digitalis is the drug of choice. Cardiac dropsy, because whenever the heart dilates, it's unable to pump blood. So the blood starts collecting. It starts collecting in the heart. It starts collecting in the lungs. It starts collecting in the intercellular spaces. And that is manifested clinically in the form of dropsy or generalized swelling. And it is called as a cardiac dropsy. Again, whenever the heart, the blood starts collecting in the lungs, then patients manifest as cough along with bloody, frothy mucus. So in this situation, digitalis can be used. Digitalis, when I'm talking about homeopathically, it is not to be used, contraindicated in acute myocardial infarction, because it slows the pulse and makes it irregular. So
can you repeat that one? Digitalis homeopathically?
Digitalis, both homeopathically as well as in modern medicine, is not to be used in the acute phase of heart attack or a myocardial infarction, because basically, whenever the heart is in crisis or in myocardial infarction, the pulse is very slow. And digitalis, because of its action on the AV node, slows down the pulse so further and makes it irregular. And this is very fatal. And that is why it is contraindicated in acute myocardial infarction. Even in potency form, we do not give this drug during the acute phase of myocardial infarction. It's a special caution. Now, people who know some sort of physiology or the anatomy of the human body, for them this slide is helpful. And for the students of homeopathy, we are asked by scientists or the so-called people from all for modern medicine as to where does digitalis act. And just answering them that the digitalis does not act, I mean it acts on the vital force, who does not satisfy them. Because they don't know what is the vital force, they don't know what is miasm. So it's quite difficult to explain to them the dynamic terms or the dynamics of digitalis. What is easier for them to, for us to explain to them is in their own words, that is in the words of physiology. So the physiological action of digitalis on the cardiovascular system is, number one, it enhances the Frank-Starling mechanism. Now, Frank-Starling mechanism is a very, very simple mechanism, although the name may be scary, Frank and Starling, but anyway, it's a very easy mechanism. Just think heart as a rubber band. Whenever you stretch the rubber band and release it, the release or the rebound is with greater force, and it hits the finger with a greater force. So, same is the case with heart muscle also. Whenever the heart muscle is stretched and released, the stretch is released, then the force of contraction is greater. So this is a physiological mechanism, a natural mechanism of the body to increase the force of contraction if the force is decreased due to any reason. Physiology digitalis enhances this mechanism, this rubber band mechanism or myocardial stretch mechanism, or in other words, Frank-Starling mechanism, so that by this action it can help the nature or help the heart to increase the force of contraction when the force of contraction decreases in disease form. Because of this action, again, digitalis helps in causing myocardial hypertrophy. Hypertrophy means enlargement of the size of the muscle of the heart. But it is not dilatation. It's a step previous to dilatation. Hypertrophy, hyper means more, trophy means enlargement. So, hypertrophy means increase in muscle mass and increase in muscle size, but it is not dilatation. Dilatation, you lose the strength. Hypertrophy, the strength is increased. Along with it, digitalis has great action on kidneys. Rather, it was a drug specially meant for kidneys as a diuretic, and very late in its evolution did people know that it actually works on the heart too. Basically, for all these years, in the 15th century and 16th century and there onwards, they have been using digitalis as a kidney remedy and not a heart remedy. So it acts on the kidneys and decreases the salt and water retention. Also, it causes peripheral vasodilatation by acting on the parasympathetic stimulation. See, we have got three types of nervous system. One is the central nervous system, which includes the brain and the spinal cord. We have a peripheral nervous system, all the peripheral nerves in the body, that is the nerves supplying the heart, the lungs, the muscles and the bones, etc. And we have got an autonomic nervous system, which is comprised of sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Now, that autonomic system, nervous system, is controlled by the hypothalamus. And digitalis has special effect on increasing the parasympathetic supply. Moment parasympathetic supply is increased, you have got the entire muscle relaxes, and that is where we have got peripheral vasodilatation and slowing of the heart rate also. Now, why this is important? Because as a rule, whenever the heart is under great or the entire constitution is under great stress, the body selectively gives blood to important the vital organs and decreases the blood supply to less vital organs. So the vital organs for survival are the heart, the brain, the lungs and kidneys, the liver. These five are vital organs. Skin, muscles, the teeth and all others are less, the gastrointestinal tract, they are less vital. So that is why the blood is shunted out from those organs and greater impact is given on the vital organs. Now this is done by parasympathetic stimulation, and digitalis helps in this mechanism to a very great extent. A wonderful mechanism of digitalis on the lungs is to cause cough, a dry cough, and this cough is important to expel the pooled plasma or the blood in the interalveolar space. Whenever, as I said, in congestive cardiac failure, the blood starts collecting in the lungs, because the lung has a great, it's a sponge, and sponge has a great capacity to hold liquid. Because of that, the patient experiences breathlessness, and because of breathlessness, the patient is unable to sleep properly, especially in the supine position. So patients get up repeatedly on and off in the night, take deep breaths and sleep again, lie down. So patients are unable to lie down. Once you start digitalis, you start having a cough, and that cough will expel out this pooled plasma, and it's a very, very important mechanism so that the lungs can expand fully well. So, my dear friends, this is the physiological action of digitalis on the cardiovascular system. Even homeopathic digitalis acts in this way.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, this was a normal heart. What happens in heart failure? Same things happen in the heart failure. Only thing is that the conditions are, properties are enhanced. For example, positive ionotropic action means the pumping capacity of the heart is increased or is rather doubled by digitalis. So that is called positive. Ionotropic means pumping capacity and action. So positive ionotropic action is the chief effect of digitalis on a failed heart. It slows the rapid ventricular rate. Whenever the heart is pumping less or the capacity of the heart decreases, it starts or tries to fight it out and increases the rate. So force is decreased, the rate is increased. But the moment you give digitalis, the force increases and the rate decreases. And this is done because of vagal stimulation. It reduces the plasma neurohormones, norepinephrine, aldosterone, and renin. And by reduction of those hormones, you can tackle, or it helps to tackle, congestive cardiac failure very effectively. And most important, it causes diuresis, and that is by inhibition of tubular reabsorption of sodium. Now, what is meaning of this tubular reabsorption of sodium means? See, in normal urine or in failed heart, lots of sodium is being given away by the body. It is the kidneys give away sodium more than average, and the body loses sodium to a great extent. By stopping this, it helps to maintain the blood pressure. Digitalis does so. It acts on, there's a pump which is called sodium potassium ATPase pump, which helps to conserve sodium. So by the mechanism, this is becoming too technical for a layperson. But
it
still,
sounds good. It sounds good to me. Keep going. I think it's okay. I think a layperson would really become a little bit more educated and understand about the sodium level in the and the interaction of the different organs. Great. Keep going.
So basically, the concentrating and diluting ability of the kidney. See, kidney concentrates certain amount of products like urea, like creatinine, like sodium, like potassium, and it dilutes certain amount of products which has to be thrown away from the body. So this action of the kidney, concentration and diluting ability, is particularly taken care of or comes under the purview of digitalis, and more so in cases of heart failure. The entire aim of digitalis being to decrease the work of the heart, to relax the heart as much as possible, increase the force of contraction, maintain the blood pressure, and at the same time decrease the symptomatology of the failed heart. That is breathlessness, that is swelling. So these two are decreased. This it does so by reducing plasma neurohormones and diuresis. Now, what are the indications of various types of digitalis in various types of congestive cardiac failure? Heart failures are of various types. You can see there are for people who don't know about heart, I should say there are four chambers. The upper chambers are called as atria, and the lower chambers are called ventricles. There's a right ventricle and a left ventricle, right atria and the left atria. So you can have a right-sided heart failure. That means the right atrium and the right atrium and the right ventricle can be completely failed. For example, in cases of chronic obstructive airway disease or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a person who has got long-standing bronchitis, long-standing asthma for 10 years, 20 years, 25 years, he or she starts developing increased pressure on the right side of the heart, because the right side of the heart supplies blood to the lungs. So if the lung is diseased for a long, long time, the entire pressure is transmitted to the right side and the right side starts failing. So you can have a right side heart failure. And if you have a right side heart failure, the drug of choice is digitalis. Then you can have a left sided heart failure in which there are other symptomatology. But digitalis is not the first drug of choice in left sided heart failure. The first drug of choice would be strophanthus or Adonis vernalis homeopathically in left-sided heart failures. Then you can have a sudden heart failure. That means in a span period of only 1 or 2 days or at the most 1 week, the heart has failed. That is called an acute heart failure. In this situation, you don't use drugs like digitalis. You use drugs like aconite napalius, aconite ferox, wherein you have got sudden or acute heart failure, the drug of choice would be aconite ferox. Whereas if you have a heart, chronic heart failure, if the heart is failing over a period of weeks to months, say 6 months or a year, then it is another name is called as cardiomyopathy, then the drug of choice would be digitalis. Then there are different types. Again, the heart failure can be divided into low output heart failure and a high output heart failure. You have drugs, diseases like hypertension, in which the heart is working too much, and because of such the great amount of working, it is failed. So that causes a high output. The output is very high. Thyrotoxicosis and hypertension causes high output heart failure. In this, the entire system is charged. Entire economy is charged. You have got symptoms like palpitation. You have got symptoms like breathlessness. You have got symptoms like excess sweating. You have got symptoms like loss of appetite. Excess heat in your body. In such situations, digitalis does not work. But in the opposite situations, hypothyroidism, low-lying situations, aortic stenosis, mitral stenosis, where there's low output heart failure, the heart is beating very slowly and the output is low, then in such situations, the drug of choice would be digitalis.
I think your earlier explanation helps us understand that a lot, because you were talking about the muscle, the Frank Starling mechanism with creating more force. I'm learning from you. I'm trying to make a little sense out of it. So you're saying when there's low output of the muscle of the heart, then you can use the digitalis in these cases to increase the pressure?
It increases the pressure. It causes the heart to, the Frank Starling mechanism is a rubber band effect. I mean, you stretch the rubber band and you release it suddenly. So you can have a greater force of contraction. So the same way digitalis acts in the heart, it causes myocardial hypertrophy. That means it stretches the myocardial muscle and releases it so that it beats with a greater force. Of course, many molecular mechanisms are involved, which I can't go into depth. But digitalis requires time. It is not a drug which acts suddenly. It requires great amount of time. It is like gelsemium. Gelsemium, the symptoms of gelsemium, and the proving of gelsemium, the symptoms develop very slowly. It is a wonderful drug for flu, but the flu has to develop suddenly over 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. Gelsemium. So also digitalis for heart failure. The disease has to develop slowly, and the digitalis acts very slowly. It's a slow-acting drug.
Okay.
So it requires situations similar to that. You can't give gelsemium as the first drug of choice in flu on the first day. You may rather think of aconite, or you may think of Hypersulf. But if it is exceeded day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, then you think of gelsemium. So as it's an analogy, like gelsemium in flu, so digitalis in chronic heart conditions. In homeopathically, homeopathy, we don't divide CCF, congestive cardiac failures, as above mentioned, that is right side or left side. It hardly matters for homeopath. Chronic or acute heart failure, or low output or high output failure. But in homeopathy, we divide congestive cardiac failure as breathlessness predominant or edema predominant or both. Because you can have a heart failure where you can have generalized swelling, which is called edema predominant, because edema is swelling. Or you can have heart failure wherein breathlessness is the predominant symptom, or you can have both. So, fortunately, digitalis acts on both such types of heart failure, that is breathlessness predominant and edema predominant. Now, as with other drugs, one should also learn what is digitalis toxicity and what are the causes of digitalis toxicity. And when I speak of digitalis toxicity, we are speaking from modern medicine point of view, because homeopathic mother tincture digitalis does not, and I say repeat it again, does not cause toxicity. and that is a great advantage of using homeopathy over modern medicine, as far as digital is concerned. But modern medicinally speaking, we have to see this drug because it has been used to very, very great extent and studied to a great extent by modern medicine cardiologists. So let us see what is digital toxicity. It is caused by high levels of digitalis in the body, number one, when you have given a constitution or a body overdose of digitalis, then obviously you can have digital toxicity, number one. Number two, the dose may be proper, but for that person, the tolerance to the drug is less. So the patients with decreased tolerance may have normal digitalis levels in the blood and still have symptoms of toxicity. Or else can occur from a single exposure or chronic over-medication, or it may occur in patients with normal blood levels of digitalis if other risks are present. For example, digitalis levels being normal, but if a person develops low potassium or low magnesium, then chances of digitalis toxicity are twice as more. Along with digitalis, if there is a concurrent diuretic therapy, which is generally the case, generally heart failure patients would have a concurrent diuretic therapy like furosemide. Along with, if a patient is there on furosemide and digitalis, then you can have low potassium and magnesium, and this itself causes increased chances of digitalis toxicity. Suppose if there is a person who has got renal dysfunction, I mean a proper kidney disease along with heart failure, then the chances of digitalis toxicity is very high because the digitalis is excreted via the kidneys and not via the liver. So, these are the chances wherein you can have digitalis toxicity. But now, how do you know that if a person is on digitalis is getting toxic? So, the first symptom you can get is confusion and drowsiness. Then you can have loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, irregular pulse, palpitations, and very peculiar visual changes which are very peculiarly seen only in digitalis, blind spots in vision, blurred vision, changes in color perception, yellow or green halos, very, very particular, yellow or green halos or rings of light around objects or seeing lights or bright spots. If the patient is complaining of repeated such sightings, like particularly the yellow or the green halos, then you should know that if the patient is on digitalis, then you should know that the patient has got digitalis toxicity. Digitalis is a diuretic, but if the patient on digitalis has got decreased urine output and you can't explain it to any other cause, then you should think of digitalis toxicity. Digitalis decreases the breathing effort of the person, but if the person has got great difficulty in breathing when lying down, then you have digitalis toxicity, excessive nocturia, and generalized swelling. If it is increasing day by day, then you are likely to have digitalis toxicity. Are you there? Hello?
Yes, I am here. We have a number of visitors in our chat that have just come in, probably from Facebook or Twitter, and we appreciate having them. We've been talking for about 50 minutes now on the show about digitalis and masters of homeopathy and answering questions from the listeners. If you have any comments or questions, we do appreciate you putting them into the chat there and or going to homeoacad.org, and there is a place where you can ask questions, and Dr. Adil will answer on air in the coming shows in 2013. This has been very educational. We're learning about digitalis, both allopathically and homeopathically, seeing what kind of toxicity can occur in different patients. Go ahead.
Yeah. A very interesting trial was conducted. That is called Digitalis Investigation Group Trial, or DIG trial, D-I-G trial. And it is a very, very important milestone trial as far as digitalis was concerned. It was conducted because digitalis, while has been in common use for many decades, there was little data from randomized trials document its efficacy in treating heart failure. The DIG trial was designed to put the issue to rest once and for all, whether or not Digitalis still a wonder drug in today's era. So the main findings of this trial, and it was a significant trial, and I repeat it again, the main findings were digoxin or Digitalis does not improve mortality in patients with heart failure. But in very few percentage of cases, it does seem to reduce the need for hospitalization in heart failure patients. The second important point was, women in the DIG trial who received digoxin had a 4% increase in cardiovascular death as compared to women taking placebo. This translates to one excess death for every 25 women taking digoxin. A very, very important observation as far as Digitalis use was concerned. The third observation, digoxin might substantially increase the risk of death in heart failure patients. The fourth observation, in the modern era, even taking the results of the DIG trial at face value, there are far more effective treatments for heart failure than digoxin. If beta blockers or ACE inhibitors and diuretics are used to the full potential, it is likely that digoxin will not be needed and may not be additionally effective at all. And lastly, using digoxin in women with heart failure before beta blockers and ACE inhibitors have been added and the dose is maximized ought to be considered bad medicine.
Okay.
All your people who are thinking of Digitalis is a wonder drug and should actually go through Digitalis investigation group trial or DIG trial. These were quite shocking to the medical world because.
Did you see the year that this trial was done so that people know?
No, I don't have the year, but I only have the trial.
Okay.
It is there in the net. I mean, the DIG trial is a very, very famous trial. I don't know the year, I'm sorry.
But most physicians should know about this, should they not?
Yeah, every physician should know, not most. Every physician, whichever science he or she belongs, if you have to use Digitalis, you should know this. Because
Okay. The
entire purpose of doing this trial was to either substantiate the hypothesis or defunct the hypothesis that Digitalis is a master drug for heart failure. And unfortunately, it has not held its reputation in this trial. Since I had to conduct this, last time, I think, when was the last interview? Before 12th?
Yes, two shows previous to this
28th November.
Okay.
So on 30th November, you told me that you wanted this Digitalis, one of the audience wanted a show on Digitalis. So
mm-hmm.
since that time, I have been asking about 56 physicians in Central India, how they feel, my own colleagues, you should use Digitalis in heart failure patients, or are they using regularly heart failure in their own patients? The allopathic Digitalis we are talking about, not homeopathy. So I could get hold of 56 physicians and I telephoned them, I sent them messages, I sent them emails asking them their efficacy or their experience on the use of digoxin in clinical practice. And only 4-5% favored the use. In 56 physicians, only 5% favored use of digoxin in heart failure as the first drug of choice in congestive cardiac failure or in arrhythmias. A percentage, 43 or 45% of patients, the physicians said, we use Digitalis, but as a last resort, or after we have used ACE inhibitors and beta blockers to the full extent, if we don't find results, then we have not totally abandoned them, but we can use Digitalis, but then we are not happy, and we would prefer using Digitalis as a last resort. So they are using less, 47% patients. And more than 50% patients, the physicians have abandoned the use of digitalis in today's age. And they are more than happy.
Mm-hmm.
More than happy with other drugs than digitalis.
Did you ask homeopaths or just allopathic?
No, cardiologists.
Okay.
Problem is, if homeopaths can't give me this objectivity, they don't get heart patients too often. And even if they get heart patients, they give digitalis, but they are not keeping a tab on the digitalis and they are not studying the effects. Modern medicine people, they do have, if they are giving it, they have some basis and they have quite good experience and they are using it particularly on heart failure patients or the arrhythmias because of digitalis. So I further asked them a question. You use digitalis, those people who favored using digitalis or you were using less digitalis, I asked them, you use digitalis because it's a protocol or are you satisfied with the results? And many of them replied that they use digitalis only because it's a protocol and not because they're satisfied with the results. So they have been giving their patients day in and day out digitalis. But till the patients get toxicity, the patients keep on receiving digitalis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they have to rely on regular protocols in order to maintain what they're supposed to do. So they just
exactly.
go ahead like a robot.
But clinically, their patients are not happy and now the physicians also not happy. But in spite of that, they're not stopping.
Mm-hmm.
Those 5% of patients, which I am saying.
So we all have to be rebellious in some way.
We have to question the therapy which we are taking. Is it beneficial for us? If yes, then we go ahead. If not, then we have to question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As far as digitalis and homeopathy is concerned, the symptoms, the particular heart symptoms would be, there's a sudden sensation that heart stood still. The heart would stop beating if she moved. This sensation is very much pronounced in people who ought to receive homeopathic digitalis, whether in tincture or in potency form. We give digitalis when the pulse is very small, slow, feeble, intermittent every third, fifth and seventh beat. If the patient has got mild cyanosis or blue discoloration of the skin, if the body or the skin is cold to touch, and if the patient has got a sensation of suffocation, then apart from other drugs, it can also call in for digitalis. But I would like to use first try Antemtate, or else I would like to try Carbovege before actually giving digitalis in a patient who has got blueness, coldness and suffocation. The basic digitalis patient who would like to receive digitalis would be very despondent, very fearful, anxious for the future. All his complaints would be aggravated by sitting erect after meals and in music.
Wait, repeat that last part about, is that better or worse for sitting erect and music?
Worse after meals and worse hearing music. And
okay.
Better empty stomach and better in open air. And again I repeat, digitalis homeopathically is contraindicated during the episode of myocardial infarction, even when the pulse is slow. In the ECG, the digitalis shows ST depression, whereas myocardial infarction, there is ST elevation.
So that's a good caution that people should recognize.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to become slight more technical because that is the use of digitalis, homeopathic digitalis, in the various types of arrhythmias where it is still a master remedy as far as homeopathy is concerned.
Can I ask you, you left me a message that you had limited time today. Are you okay? Because we've gone past time.
No problem. I'll be finishing this.
Because
I've given you various ECGs where digitalis is used, but then I'm not going to go in depth of those ECGs because very, very few people would be able to understand those ECGs. But still, since it was an interview, since I'm preparing a PowerPoint presentation, might as well give all those ECGs where homeopathy would be beneficial, particularly homeopathic digitalis. So, as far as arrhythmias are concerned, specific cardiac arrhythmias, the first arrhythmia is supraventricular tachycardia. Supra means above the ventricle. If there is tachycardia or increased heart rate, then a special type of ECG is shown and it responds to digitalis. Atrial tachycardia with block. Suppose if a person has got frequent PVCs, P means premature, V means ventricular, and C is contraction. Premature ventricular contraction. Ventricular contraction is lup-thup. But suppose if you got lup-lup-lup-thup, that means the ventricle is beating twice as fast, or the beat has come too soon before the next peak, then it's called premature ventricular contraction. And homeopathically, it's a very important indication of digitalis. Then we can have ventricular bigeminy, trigeminy, sinus bradycardia, that means slow pulse, AV block, atrioventricular block, first degree, second degree, and third degree, regularized AF, that is atrial fibrillation. AF is a standard nomenclature for atrial fibrillation. And last is ventricular tachycardia. That means if the ventricle is beating way too fast, very, very fast, that is more than 150 beats per minute, ranging 360, 500 beats per minute, it is called VTAC or ventricular tachycardia, and digitalis really helps in this. The coming slides, I have given you various ECGs, bigeminal, paroxysmal atrial tachycardia plus block, coarse AF and atrial tachycardia. All these may look difficult or very, very big things for lay people, but yet I have given them. And finally, the repertory, the rubrics for digitalis would be chest congestion, heart constriction, night constriction, falling asleep, dilatation of heart, chest fullness of heart, hepatization of lung, dropsy, disease with organic, hypertrophy of the heart, infiltration of heart and lungs. These are all different rubrics. Respiration difficult, midnight, paroxysmal, cough, night, choking, breathing, rattling, infant sin. So all these are few of the rubrics where digitalis would come up as the first remedy or the predominant remedy to be used. Of course, these are nothing but symptoms of heart failure. And finally, I have tried to compare the four most very, very closely related drugs in heart failure, and arsenic alb, antemtart, carbovec, and China. All these four drugs resemble the state, the disease state where digitalis is also indicated. So you have to distinguish the four drugs and then choose digitalis. You just cannot choose digitalis outrightly. The arsenic album, a person who has to receive arsenic alb, whether because of heart failure or anything, should have got mental distress, should be very fearful, should be anxious, restless, and thirsty. In arsenic alb, there's extreme cardiac pressure or burning. The patient says, "Doc, I've got increased burning in the chest." Call it acidity, call it whatever you want to call, but the patient complains of a pressure feeling on the sternum and great burning. Cannot get enough air in the lungs, says she will die. Arsenic alb is the remedy before putting the patient on mechanical ventilation. I repeat, arsenic alb is a remedy before putting the patient on mechanical ventilation. If you are sure that this patient is about to require mechanical ventilation, please give arsenic then. It's a drug of choice for sudden heart failure, and the highest possible potency available should be used. You can repeat it 15 to 20 minutes, and you will get a response in 30 to 40 minutes. And we have seen many patients who have responded to LVF, left ventricular failure. LVF means left ventricular failure. Left ventricular failure is a near fatal condition if not tackled in time. And arsenic alb is the drug of choice. Arsenic acts temporarily, and to stop relapse of failure, use phosphorus 1M1 dose. Once you are sure that arsenic has acted completely, the patient has settled down, you know that the patient is still in failure and the crisis attack will recur again, then stop arsenic, use one dose of phosphorus, and you may not get failure again. So this is use of arsenic in a state which is very similar to digitalis or heart failure case. The second drug is antimony tartaricum, a wonderful drug wherein the state of disposition of the patient or the state in which you find the patient is exactly opposite that of arsenic. Arsenic is very active, very restless. Here the antimony patient is very depressed, very hopeless, very exhausted, very sleepy. The arsenic is very thirsty. Here is absolutely thirstless. The arsenic does not have a coating on the tongue. Here the coating of the tongue is quite deep, even if the patient is in a failure state. Then there's mild cyanosis. Then if you keep your stethoscopes on the lungs, you can hear bubbling sounds, which are called basal rails. And you can have edema on the legs or swelling on the legs, swelling below the eyes, swelling above the eyes. All the symptoms, if the patient's symptoms are aggravated or increased in a stuffed room or heat, but in spite of that, the patient hates a blast of air or fan, hates wearing an oxygen mask, then you should think of antimony tart and not arsenic. History of gradual progressive failure, you can use again antimony tart in very high potency and repetition fractional doses in every 1 or 3 hours. So this is how antimony tart needs to be used in heart failure. Then we have got carbo-veg. The state of disposition of the patient is mentally dull, foggy, extreme air hunger. Patient is very, very breathless. Rather, the breathlessness is the predominant feature of carbo-veg. The patient has got cold, clammy limbs, but still does not want them to be covered. Desires fan, desires air, wants air. Patient wants fan. Cannot bear any clothing around the neck. And patient has a gaseous distension of epigastrium and a good deal of flatulence. And the patient, if the patient passes flatus, feels well. The BP is very low, low volume pulse, craves oxygen inhalation, and it is again a remedy for weaning the patient from mechanical ventilation. Suppose if you have a patient who is already ventilated, already intubated, and you want to take out the patient from the mechanical ventilation, use carbo-veg. Carbo-veg, stop carbo-veg as soon as the improvement occurs and follow up with Kali-Carb. Carbo-veg is a remedy which should not be you can't keep on giving for days together. Moment you feel that carbo-veg is acted, stop the drug and follow up with low potency of Kali-Carb in 30 or 200 as you feel fit. So this is carbo-veg in cardiac failure. And last is a drug very, very similar to Digitalis. It is China. Suffocative attacks aggravated by walking, cardiac dropsy. Mentally, the patient is very irritable, very sensitive, hurts others' feelings. That means when the patient is irritative, patient abuses the caretaker and insults him or her. This is quite similar to Digitalis, who also does the same thing. Basically, a China patient would not hurt you, but in the times of agony, the only thing is cursing and swearing. That is not given as a rubric, but we see it clinically, and it fits China. A China patient has got a dull look, a pale, waxy face, but as opposed to Digitalis, the pulse is very strong, very hard, rapid, and irregular. There is ventricular tachycardia, as opposed to the bradycardia of Digitalis. So a differentiating point between Digitalis and China is a strong, hard, rapid, irregular pulse. Of course, time does not permit me to speak much more, but it was wonderful speaking on Digitalis as much as I could.
Fantastic. Let me see. I'm live here with you with Dr. Adil Chimtalawala Kasim, who is our regular guest co-host to the Homeopathy World Community show on Blog Talk Radio, Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and I believe that's 9 p.m. in India.
Yeah, in India. India, right. Indian subcontinent. And I wish my viewers and audience, and of course you, Debbie, a very, very happy Christmas and a happy New Year. May God bless. Hope the agony of 2012 ends here. And as the Mayan Karen calendar describes so many myths about the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, they still remain myths, I believe. They should.
Well,
and we should enter 2013 with a bang.
Be careful about the bang.
Yeah.
I, you know what? The myths about the ending of the entire world as it is, I think that it could be metaphorically true, and let's hope that is true. From all the spiritualists that I hear from, that we are going through the birthing pains of a new world for us, for hopefully into a place of more peace. And sometimes birth is not easy, is it? So
yeah, I totally agree. So hope there. I mean, whatever you said is true. And with these words, I go tomorrow to start my postgraduate winter school. And if ever in your life time permits, homeopaths particularly, or people who love to learn homeopathy, you are always invited to my small humble nursing home, homeopathic hospital, where we teach homeopathy and learn homeopathy together for 10 days in the winter and 14 days in summer. So to our winter school, postgraduate residential winter school starts tomorrow, that is 20th, and will end on the 30th. So 10 days of grueling homeopathy, but fun-filled homeopathy. With all the people I have got from India and abroad, many have registered. We have got 30 good people, and I hope to spend good time with them and enter with them the new year, that is 2013. Good night. Goodbye.
Good night to you. And for those who are listening, I will continue on for another 28 minutes, giving you some more information about what you can gather from Homeopathy World Community, upcoming shows that we've got going, and some information. If I have a little bit of time, I might even read from Dr. Herbert Roberts and continue the study of the principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy. So I want to thank Dr. Adil always. We love him and having him on. Last week I gave a great big plug for his program in India. If you miss it this year, I'm sure that you will be interested in it for next year. For he said it's grueling, and he does mean that it is. If I told you the list of things that you're going to be studying in from December 21st to December 30th, it runs probably at this time of year every year. The National Academy of Homeopathy in India is organizing this 21st Residential Homeopathic PG Winter School.
Exactly.
In addition to, you were saying that you have yoga for exercise of the body, mind, and spirit every day to get started.
We teach doctors how to practice yoga and how to impart them in their own patients daily in their lives. I mean, they should, if they know yoga, then they can ask the patients to conduct yoga and conduct small sessions of yoga in their own small clinics. So what's wrong? It's very compatible.
Absolutely, and it's being instituted in many of the hospitals around America as well, to realize that meditation and yoga can be so beneficial for all disease, reducing stress, and especially the cardiologists have implemented this. So this is fantastic. And then you're going to give live case presentations, analysis and discussion.
Yeah.
I'm just going to run through some of the stuff for the listeners so that they know the incredible amount of learning that goes on during these, is it 9 or 10 days?
Ten
whole days of, I think, probably constant study. Live presentation, analysis and discussion, audiovisual demonstrations of model case-taking procedures, case types, miasmatic evolution, repertorization and plan of management, approach for the second prescription, which is like highly needed for, of course, we can figure out what to do initially, but then how do you follow up? And then applied philosophy, doctrines of idiopathogenesis, living hexity, and I never heard the word hexity before, but maybe you'll teach me sometime.
Yeah. Sometime we'll keep a show on this, the different concepts which we have eased, which help us in understanding homeopathy much better. They are framed by the National Academy of Homeopathy India, and it does help us in understanding the concepts very, very clearly.
Evolution of sickness and disease, eliminations, ultimates and end results. I hope I'm making everybody, their mouth water, to want to get get there. Concomitants, those are like everything that Dr. Herbert Roberts talks about is concomitants. Suppression, palliation and cure, susceptibility and resistance, defense systems, miasmas, rational management, human mind, and psychosomiasis. And then there's the live materia medica clinical examinations of practical repertorizations, drug potency, and selection. People are always asking about potency selection. Lectures on homeopathic cardiology, neuroendocrinology, psychiatry, gastroenterology. And I think people also recognize the close tie between the digestive system and the mind, brain. So there's a lot going on there. Homeopathic emergency management sessions, physiotherapy demonstrations, psychotherapy sessions, labor management under the supervision of the Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics, ward rounds with detailed discussion on each case. Wow, bedside and emergency. This is like a crash course. Homeopathic manuals, planning and implementations, peri- and post-operative operative homeopathic management, analysis and interpretations of modern investigatory techniques like ECG, TMT, EEG.
ECG is electrocardiogram.
Yes, EEG, and X-rays, angiocardiograms, CT scans, MRIs, echocardiograms, and USG films. Wow. And if you're going to crash course these people, they should come out like their head's spinning. I don't know. It sounds like an incredible session. On,
many people believe that only 10 days are, how can you do these so many things in 10 days? But then we have been doing it for past 20 years, and we have been seeing results.
Take your vitamins. I don't know. Okay, so I wish you well, and I will be back with you in 2013. In the meantime, for the folks who are still listening, I will carry on with The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy by Dr. Herbert Roberts. Last session, I talked about the chief complaint and the auxiliary symptoms in their relationship to the case. And Dr. Roberts was talking about the two distinct phases, the two separate parts, the part comprising the symptoms of which the patient complains, those which are most annoying to him and most outstanding in his recognition, and secondly, those symptoms which he does not recognize as symptoms or which he does not consider worth reporting or does not consider as having any relationship to the case. So that's the job for the homeopath to distinguish and elicit through the case-taking procedure to learn what are the striking, particular, and unusual and peculiar symptoms, and the concomitants is something that he really emphasized in the last session of talking and finding the similimum, the most similar of all the remedies. And now we're on to chapter 12, the dynamic action of drugs. He says, we often speak of Hahnemann as the first to note the similar action of drugs and disease conditions, but history shows us that this is not so. 10 centuries BC, the ancient Hindu system of medicine was founded on the theorem, which translated reads in almost identical words to those Hahnemann used. Again, Aristotle, about 350 BC, gave the following dictum. If simile acts upon simile, the result of this mutual action reveals itself in neutralization, annihilation of the original qualities, and in production of another state, which is exactly contrary to the previous one. If the simile, which is the similar, of the remedy acts upon the simile of the disease, the result of this mutual action is neutralization, annihilation of the original qualities vis-a-vis of the pathopoiesis of, I don't know what that word is, but it is, I'll have to look up some Latin, of the remedy and the pathogenesis of the organism and change into the contrary state vis-a-vis health, unquote. And that was Aristotle. However, it may be about the length of time elapsed since the recognition of the law of similars. The question of dose was one which Hahnemann solved. So this is potency in homeopathic terms. The question of dose rests upon the philosophy pertaining to the practice of homeopathy. Ignoring the law of dosage reveals a lack of concept of the dynamic influence over matter. In life, the dynamic force is a manifestation of life itself. The body and tissues are not life, but they are the channels through which life functions. The man who sees this glimpses the basis of vitalism, that there is a whole world of causes prior to the world of effects, that matter is indestructible, and that force is transmitted through matter, and therefore it too is indestructible. Matter may change in form, but it is always present. This is E equals MC squared, is it not? From Einstein, and it hopefully answers the previous question at the beginning of the show from the doctor in Texas. Force may change its expression, but no unit of force is ever destroyed. We hold that force on energy or dynamis, whatever you wish to call it, is the law of nature. It may express its powers in different ways, but in its essence, it is that which was breathed into man at his creation, which made him a living soul. The expression of this law may vary and find different expressions, as attraction, gravity, electricity, chemical affinity, dynamis, or spiritual power. It is an expression of and all combined under one head and source of power, God. So we can see these actions in the remedy digitalis is what we were talking about today, and the mechanical means in the change in chemistry, in the power of phosphorus and magnesium and the other salts in the body, in the power of the liquid water in the body, how it coagulates, how it floods the different organs, as Dr. Adil was explaining. What keeps us alive, what keeps us functioning and in balance? It is the vital force. Hahnemann, he says, Dr. Roberts, was a representative of this school of thought, and he plumbed deeply into these mysteries. He became dissatisfied with the thought of his day, and he read extensively the medical works of the ancients. In his delvings, he found several not long before his own time, like Stahl of Denmark and Hale of Switzerland, who had observed that medicines might cure disease by the power they possessed of causing like diseases in healthy human beings. He comprehended that these men had observed this phenomena, but that it had been allowed to fall into disuse without application. At this stage, Hahnemann determined to discover the action of drugs upon human beings by observing all the details of their action upon healthy subjects. And that's what we call his provings or his clinical trials. Hahnemann did not originate this idea of proving drugs upon healthy individuals. Aha! But he was the first to so prove with a definite object in view. After thorough pain taking, intelligent systematic study and comparisons, after many long, tedious, self-sacrificing ordeals, Hahnemann was able to work out and announce to the world the existence of an heretofore unsuspected universal law of cure, not an occasional means of cure, as had been anticipated by those of recent generations. This was the first step which culminated in the evolution of a new, rational, and scientific system of medical practice. And we know that science is being able to repeat the same thing over and over. So here, Dr. Herbert Roberts is telling us this is not an occasional means of cure, but it is something that can be repeated. It is a scientific system of medical practice. The full recognition of the law of similars rapidly succeeded the proving of drugs and was the second step in the evolution of homeopathic principles. Hahnemann began the experiments of the application of proven drugs for the cure of the sick upon the basis of the law of similars, but using drugs in their full strength. He found that many times the patient became greatly aggravated. Hahnemann reasoned that the dose was too large. It sounds almost like the three bears. And everybody knows that story. It was too big. And he experimented by diluting the drug on a definite scale. To his surprise, he found he secured better results. He continued this process until he discovered that the curative power of drugs bore no proportionate relationship to the crude quantity, but that under the peculiar and systematic reduction by a regular scale and the proper manipulation, many drugs in common use and many substances supposed to be inert in their crude state became endowed with new and hitherto unsuspected activities and power. He's unleashed the mystery of the inert substances on Earth as well. And if you want to look into modern potency scale, learn from someone who is doing the Fibonacci series, which is completely a natural series of numbers. And we did a show in the past with the author of that. So Hahnemann, setting out simply to reduce the quantity of his doses, discovered potentization, an entirely new principle in posology, a wonderful development in the world of therapeutics, without which the law of cure would have been forgotten. This is the principle which gives life and power to the system of medicine which Hahnemann developed, and this is the third great step in the evolution of the law of cure. As Morgan says, quote, "To Hahnemann alone is due imperishable honor and renown for discovering first the existence of a universal law of cure, and second, that the specific properties of drugs could be developed, transmitted, and utilized by potentization." And this is what we use when we dilute and succuss our substances. With the discovery of potentization, or dynamization, as it is called, began the first practical tests of the newly discovered law of cure. Crude drugs have three grades of action: mechanical, chemical, and dynamic. The first two grades are of little comparative note in homeopathy. This is demonstrated by the fact that their provings in crude form produce comparatively little of worth, whereas in those provings made from the 30th and above, we obtain more complete provings because of the dynamic action. The full power of the drug in its dynamic action is brought out in the potency, whereas the grosser material elements, by their very crudity, develop no fine individualities in their provings. Entirely new activities are developed, liberated, and may be transmitted and changed into the potentizing medium. And this comes from, he refers to, the Organon 269. This is shown by the potentization of inert substances like carbovegetabilis, which was mentioned today in as a heart remedy for those who desire air. Lycopodium, which is used as it's a ancient club moss, which was used anciently as a powder around drugs. Silica, that comes from sand and sea. Let us look at a recent book published in his time of 1933. This is when this article was written, dealing with, quote, "The Mode of Action of Drugs on Cells" by A.J. Clark, A.B., M.D., F.R.C.P., F.R.S., those are all his initials, professor of Materia Medica at the University of Edinburgh, formerly professor of pharmacology in the universities of London and Cape Town. This book deals with the matter entirely from the orthodox medical viewpoint, yet here his comment relative to the biological response of cell-drug reactions. And remember, we were studying earlier in the show about the heart and the special type of cells, muscular cells of the heart. Quote, this is a quote from A.J. Clark. There is very little direct evidence that the biological response is produced by a chemical reaction between the drug and the cell constituents. This assumption is chiefly justified by the fact that it is supported by much indirect evidence, and that there is no alternative hypothesis which has stronger evidence in its support. If we assume that there is some simple relation between the amount of drug entering into the combination and the extent of the biological response, then the following consideration must apply. If the fundamental chemical reaction consists in fixation of the drug by some particular constituent of the cell, then this must result in a reduction both of the free drug and of the free receptors in the cell. The relative amounts of drug solution and cells can, however, be varied at will, and hence the concentration of the drug can always be kept constant by providing a sufficient excess of drug solution. Indeed, in many cases, and this is in italics, the quantity of the drug fixed is so minute that it is difficult to reduce the drug solution to a volume small enough to show changes of concentration. And that's from page 60 of his book, The Mode of Action of Drugs on Cells. Drugs that act in high dilutions are of particular interest to pharmacology, and in such cases, true absorption may be delayed by the depletion of the layer adjoining the surface. Freudlink in 1926 states, the simpler the conditions chosen and the smaller the difficulty in securing access to the inner surface, the quicker is the adsorption. In the case of well-powdered adsorbents, the equilibrium is mostly reached in seconds or minutes, unquote from Freudlink. In the case of cell drug solution systems, in which vigorous stirring is possible, delay ought to be reduced. It is, however, necessary to remember that particles above a certain size carry with them a layer of water several micra thick, even when they are stirred thoroughly. Hence, even in cases where such stirring is possible, the delay due to depletion cannot be ignored. That's page 68 and 69. In other words, says Dr. Herbert Roberts, even modern pharmacology recognizes, one, the reaction of amounts of drugs so minute that it is not possible to tell how small the amount of the drug in the solution is, yet it still shows definite action on the cells. Two, the action is much more rapid in the case of well-powdered substances, and he is relating to triturations, which is a homeopathic term and process of grinding the substance. Three, regardless of the quality or quantity of the drug used, the solution is activated to a marked degree by vigorous stirring, which we call succussion in homeopathy. So here we see the dilution, the triturations, and the succussion are very much paramount to having action in the cell. This shows the observations of the action of infinitesimal amounts of drug on the physiological basis, that the greater the trituration, the more rapid the action, and that the influence of succussion also speeds the rate of activity markedly. But the comprehension of the vital principles upon which homeopathy is based does not follow the observations remarked by Professor Clark. It is but natural that many prescribers at first stay close to the mechanical and chemical stages, for the material always first attracts our attention. But in order to grasp this truth of dynamization, we must apply the same means of approach and travel, the same road that Hahnemann and his followers have traveled, recognizing the dynamic in health and in disease, and applying the same line of thought and reason to the study and development of the power and action of drugs. And if we think, and this is my own thought here, that we are attracted by the material at first, we see the person, we see their beauty, we see their outer beauty, and then only later do we recognize their inner beauty, their special power and force in the world. And so he says, yes, we are attracted by the outside mechanical and chemical stages, and so are prescribers, and so are doctors and homeopaths. But let us look deeper into the dynamization based upon these actions through trituration, succussion, and dilution. Dr. Roberts says, it is well to note the care and thoroughness of Hahnemann's work and the methodical way in which he developed the potency using the centesimal scale in preparing his divided dosage, and giving each step in the process vigorous succussion. This process was continued until all trace of quantity had vanished. So the material, what we see on the outside, had vanished beyond the recognition of all possible physical tests. And today we are testing with newer techniques and tools to see deeper. But will we ever see the deepest? Who knows? Yet in these higher potencies, the dynamic qualities and potential qualities survive. So as the more we dilute, the more we succuss, the more we reduce the crude drug, still the dynamic qualities and potential qualities survive. Upon applying these potencies upon man or animals, we find a far more delicate organism or apparatus than in provided in any possible physical instruments as yet developed, and that was in 1933. Possibly the furthest development of the radioactive power may in time give us a measuring instrument that may partially reveal this ability. So he was a predictor of the future, was he not? To predict that we could test the radioactive action of all substances that we do today to detect how old everything is when we do the taking a core of the earth out and testing what is unstable based on the radioactivity of that core sample. But the human organism will always be the most delicate instrument, for the susceptible subject is quick to respond to this dynamic force. And he was giving us instances that the cell was able to respond and react at the most dynamic level. And the show has been going on for 2 hours. I'm told that there is not much time left to finish, so I think I'm going to have to read part two of this chapter of The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert Roberts. I hope that it has been enlightening to all of our listeners. Please do send us comments and feedback. Has this been worthwhile to your education, to your enlightenment about understanding homeopathy, about how homeopathy works and the development of the history of homeopathy and theory and philosophy of homeopathy, please let us know whether you have enjoyed Dr. Adil's shows. And if you have any questions for him, go to homeoacad.org and send him in a question, or post your question directly onto Homeopathy World Community at Facebook, or send me a note on Twitter at Debbie Brock on Twitter. And please go to Homeopathy World Community for our latest news and whatever is happening live. You will see on the main page the banners to the Health In Show, which occurs on Mondays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, which is 9:30 in India p.m. And we are going to have upcoming a number of great shows on the Health In. We're going to have Wendy Hewlett, the homeopath to the stars from Hollywood. We're going to have Kate Birch and Cilla Watcott coming up in January talking about homeoprophylaxis. And if you've missed our incredible most watched show with Dr. Isaac Golden, that was on this past Monday. The archives are available with slides, with a lot of notes and information about homeopathy used as preventative to infectious and contagious disease, which we call homeoprophylaxis. We're going to be having Janie Goddard talking about the revolutionary practice of mind-body medicine. And in the future, in March, we're going to have Senya talking about astrology and homeopathy, giving a case of the benefit to a child with stammering and stuttering. We're going to have Dr. Isaac Golden return on May 20th of 2013. If you have any suggestions for homeopaths and healthcare providers that you think would be a great guest on the Health In Show, which is a live video stream, please send me a message. Let me know, and we'll see if we can contact that person and invite them onto the show. We have a lot prepared for 2013. We're wishing you all good health, happiness, joy, peace, all good things. I want to repeat the quote that I gave at the beginning of the show and see if perhaps it is applicable in your life, how you may benefit from this motivational quote by Rav Schneerson. It says, quote, "People have the wrong idea about restrictions. They imagine that if you restrict what you eat and what you do not, when you work and when you meditate and pray, what you wear, where you go, all these restrictions will suffocate any sense of inspiration. The truth is, without restrictions, your inspiration will quickly dissipate. Focus your light like a laser into an intense, powerful beam, and it will last." So what he is telling us today really ties into our study of the remedy digitalis, both allopathically and homeopathically, thinking about edema, thinking about suffocation and not being able to breathe, the position that you are able to breathe better, whether you need a fan, whether you desire air, what is happening when the oxygen in the blood is flowing through the circulatory system based on the pumping of the heart, whether you will be able to inspire or receive inspiration, whether you are using that light energy like a laser beam, like radioactive energy, like the ability to focus your energy powerfully and emit light to the world. How will you take this inspirational quote from Rav Schneerson about restrictions? What will restrictions be beneficial to you in your life? How will you apply that concept? We have so much to learn together. Please join us. Share on Twitter, share on Facebook, share on LinkedIn. Take the widget, the HTML code from these shows, put it on your very own website so that people, when they visit your site, can learn directly and stay there and listen and browse on your own pages. We have so much to give to each other. I am pleased that we had lots of guests today on the show. And what else can I tell you? We have also the availability on HWC. I wanted to let you know about a course in January given by Dr. Dinesh Chauhan of India and the Sensation Method. There is a link on the front page. We have a link to the book, The Solution, A Homeoprophylaxis, the Vaccine Alternative by Kate Birch. We have kits from Miranda Castro. The end of the year is going to end the discount, the 10% discount from her. So get that quickly if you are in need or you want to give it as a holiday gift or tell people about that. All of the Health In shows and these Blog Talk Radio shows are archived. You can listen to them at your convenience. You can download them to your MP3. You can listen to them on your mobile device. You can share them. We have the Complete Dynamics in Homeopathy computer program. Click that link to that and learn how you can have on your desktop this incredible program for homeopaths. The Materia Medica is there for you as a source. You can put in your rubrics and come up with an analysis. It's my favorite program. And if you want some help, if you're in India, besides Dr. Adil, we have Dr. Deepak Sharma, who is my co-host on the regular shows. Alan Phillips is going to be with us tomorrow on the Blog Talk Radio Vaccinations and Your Rights show, of course, talking about cutting-edge news about vaccines. Do they cause damage? Do they not? When is it appropriate to use vaccinations? What are the side effects? What about exemptions and waivers for you, whether you're an immigrant, whether you are in the military, whether you are a parent or a student, or a healthcare worker? So many reasons to educate yourself about vaccinations and your rights. Kavitha Kukunur is an inspirational homeopath who talks about her journey from India to America. And she also is a very good friend. We have Grant Bentley, facial analysis. So please take advantage of all that we have to give. Everything that we've done on this show is free. And if you have in your heart a holiday gift, go to the place on the HWC. It says donate. We would love to see a donation to help support the maintenance of the show. Everything that I do is basically my own energy. And if we have some funds coming in, it will help pay for the site and maybe even get me some volunteers. If you want to volunteer, give me a chat on the Homeopathy World Community Facebook or anywhere you're connected with me. Let me know you want to volunteer to help this programming. And I know I've gone way, way over time. I don't even know if we're live or if the show has cut off. So I'm wishing you a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.